Thanks, Keith, for introducing the conference, and thanks very much to FX Week for organising this virtual event. Today, I will provide you with an update on the recent issues that the Global Foreign Exchange Committee that I chair has been considering, as well as provide you with the state of play in the review of the FX Global Code that the GFXC is undertaking. So the GFXC has met three times this year, virtually, and each meeting we draw on the insights about FX market functioning from the 20 member foreign exchange committees from around the world. These committees encompass advanced and emerging economy FX markets and views from all parts of the market, sell side, buy side, non-banks and platforms. So in FX markets, the experience following the outbreak of COVID earlier this year was similar to what has occurred in previous market crises. Spreads widened, volatility increased sharply, liquidity deteriorated for both spot and swap markets, and funding costs surged in many currencies. These abrupt changes in market conditions can prompt rapid shifts in the structure of the market, such as the methods by which market participants execute their trades. And that happened this time around. There was a reduction in the share of trade internalization used by sell-side market participants, and a greater share of activity migrated to the primary venues. However, one notable feature of this latest crisis was both how sharply market conditions deteriorated and how quickly they recovered. The actions by central banks and governments around the world doubtless contributed to this rebound. By and large, conditions have continued to improve in recent months. Many indicators of liquidity are now approaching more normal levels, although the depth of the market does remain noticeably below pre-pandemic levels. Conditions are more diverse in emerging market currencies, where more idiosyncratic factors tend to be in play. But overall, conditions have also generally improved in these EM markets, but to a lesser extent. In periods of volatility, it is inevitable that there will be a greater focus on benchmark fixes. Large changes in asset prices and currencies generally mean that investors have greater than normal rebalancing flows when managing their portfolios. And this was certainly the case at the height of market volatility in March. Ordinarily, a lot of these rebalancing flows will go through the market at time that match benchmark fixings. So in March, the GFXC drew attention to the possible consequences of these flows around the March quarter end, or ahead of the March quarter end, cautioning market participants to be mindful of the impact of their transactions and to clearly understand how their orders are being handled. Subsequent liaisons suggested that market participants were attentive to the potential impact of these large flows. In some markets, participants looked to bring the timing of their flows ahead of month end. But while the fixings have generally proceeded smoothly, there have been occasions this year where the London 4pm fix has been associated with heightened volatility. This has prompted discussions, including at the GFXC and at its member committees, about the fixing process. And to that end, the GFXC is regularly engaging with the administrator of the WMR fixes to relay any feedback from the committee and its members to WMR. We had another conversation with WMR earlier this week, and I'm encouraged by the increased engagement by them with market participants on the issues around fixes. At the same time, however, it remains as important as ever for users of the 4pm fix and other benchmarks to regularly assess whether executing at those times suits their requirements. More broadly, the COVID lockdowns presented major operational challenges to FX market participants. These challenges were exacerbated by the market volatility, but even as market conditions stabilized, many of the operational challenges remained. However, the FX industry generally has been able to meet these challenges. A recent report issued by the GFXC that the vice chair of the GFXC, Neil Penny, drew together summarised the experiences of both buy side and sell side market participants throughout this time. Broadly speaking, electronic trading proved effective and reliable. It is likely that the COVID period will have only furthered the industry's shift towards electronic trading. This includes the greater use of execution algorithms in many markets. From the GFXC's perspective, The recent period has highlighted the importance of having common standards of industry practice. The abrupt change in market conditions that we witnessed this year also underscored the importance of transparency. As spreads widened, trade sizes were reduced, and last look rejection rates rose. Clients needed to understand the implications of this for their activity. While the code has certainly proven its value since it was introduced over 3 years ago now, the FX market is constantly evolving. When the code was launched in 2017, the GFXC committed to undertaking a review of the code every 3 years to ensure that its guidance remains appropriate and is contributing to an effectively functioning market. So let me now update you on where we are at with that three-year review. Wide-ranging feedback obtained from market participants last year confirmed that the code does remain fit for purpose. The vast majority of people that provided that feedback were comfortable with the code in its current form, at least broadly. Nevertheless, there were a few key areas where closer review was warranted. And so I'd like to provide you with an update on some of those focus areas today. Originally, we had intended to conclude the review of the code by this December, but following the outbreak of COVID, we needed to pause our work for several months. But that work has now been resumed and is on track for completion by no later than mid next year. The first focus area for the GFXC is getting greater adherence and commitment to the code from the buy side. Certainly, a lot of progress has been made over the past 3 years. For example, of the top 30 asset managers globally, more than half have now signed statements of commitment to the code, including BlackRock, Fidelity, and SSGA. There is, however, scope for further progress. In our liaison with the industry, several possible reasons have been suggested for the slower rate of take-up from the buy side. Firstly, the code has 55 principles, which is not, I don't think, too many, but there is a perception that many of them are only relevant to the sell side. Secondly, the buy side hasn't had the same incentive to sign up to the code as the sell side. The sell side has faced pressure from their regulators and their customers to demonstrate their commitment to the code and to better practice. Peer pressure amongst sell side participants has also played a role there as well. And finally, the third reason why there's been a slower rate of take up from the buy side is that with constrained resources, many buy side participants have other priorities to focus on, such as MiFID and the like. To overcome some of these issues, one question that has been asked is whether a buy side and simpler version of the code could be developed. So we considered this issue at our recent GFXC meeting in September, and the GFXC's firm conclusion was that a single code remains the best way of ensuring there is a common market standard that constitutes good practice. Prior to the FX Global Code, we had a number of codes around the world, and one of our primary aims was consolidating those codes into one single code, given it is one single global foreign exchange market. So given that, we are still of the view that a single code remains the best way of ensuring a common market standard that constitutes good practice. The diversity and increasing complexity of the FX market means that it is not always possible to assign clear roles to market participants, such as liquidity providers and liquidity consumers. Relatedly, some buy-side firms will have a larger and more complex involvement with the FX market than many smaller sell-side banks. From the outset, the GFXC has emphasised that the code should be applied by each market participant in a manner that is proportionate to the nature of their engagement in the market. It is envisaged that the larger, more complex and sophisticated an institution's FX activities are, that institution should have undertaken a more comprehensive and detailed internal exercise to ensure its adherence to the code's principles. That said, the GFXC will develop additional guidance to assist firms in identifying those principles of the code that are the most appropriate for them to evaluate when aligning their practices with the code. This will complement the existing material that is already available on the GFXC's website, including case studies of a variety of buy-side firms that have aligned their practices to the code already. Another priority for the code review is to provide further guidance around certain practices, and particularly the always controversial topics of last look and pre-hedging. It's important to point out that it's not necessarily the case that the GFXC will amend the existing principles of the code that deal with these practices. That may happen, but we are certainly aiming to provide guidance material that provides greater clarity about how these practices are used and what the relevant considerations are for market participants. So we'd be looking to provide much more detailed thinking behind the principles in the code and, as I said, provide guidance about the consideration that market participants should have in mind when they're using last look or undertaking pre-hedging. There will always be some controversy attached to these practices, so it is important that they are transparent and well understood. One important means for providing transparency in the FX market is the disclosures made by sell-side participants. In the GFXC's surveys of the industry, many market participants, especially from the buy side, still consider the disclosures around trading practices to be poor. Spoken about this a number of times before, but a lot of the disclosures have the feel of caveat emptor, which is something which I don't think meets the standard of better practice. A number of them are very dense and very hard to read. It is the areas of pre-hedging and last look that are generally of most concern to market participants in terms of disclosures. More broadly, the aim of the GFXC has been to ensure that market participants have easily accessible and understandable information on how their trades are handled, allowing them to make informed decisions. While there has been progress in this area, the committee's view is that the availability and adequacy of some elements of disclosures remains an issue. The disclosures have to be readable and have meaningful content. In part, it can be the greater volume of disclosure information that is being made available is itself proving challenging for market participants to comprehend and evaluate. Several different sets of disclosures can be produced by the one entity, with some publicly available and others provided bilaterally, dependent on the intended purpose. Across counterparties, disclosure information is often provided in an inconsistent manner with varied levels of detail. The disclosure documents are also reviewed and updated at different times by different counterparties, and there is no central repository of multiple firms' disclosures to enable comparisons. The GFXC is aiming to develop solutions that will address these issues in comparing information across different disclosure documents and facilitate access to disclosure information. The committee is also considering reviewing the code's principles in light of the increasing adoption of algo execution in the FX market. It is estimated that between 10 and 20% of FX spot trading globally is accounted for by execution algos. Usage of these algos can improve market functioning, but they also introduce risks. So, as elsewhere, the issue is how well understood these things are by market participants and whether the disclosures made by providers are adequate. Disclosures surrounding algos are often very high level. While there may be legitimate reasons why providers don't disclose certain things, such as intellectual property, it's nevertheless important that users have sufficient information to facilitate comparability amongst these instruments. Another area where the FX market has continued to evolve is the increased usage of anonymous trading. As part of its code review, the GFXC has a work stream looking at this aspect of the market and the roles provided by venue providers and prime brokers, and whether the issues that can arise with this form of trading are adequately addressed in the code's existing principles. One aspect of the market that the GFXC has been focusing on in its recent meetings is settlement risk. When conducting their triennial survey of the global FX markets last year, the BIS expanded the scope of their survey to include data on settlement methods. The BIS data suggests that the amount of trades being settled without payment versus payment, PVP, protection remains very significant and has increased. There could be several reasons for this trend, and further work is being done within the industry to understand the drivers. Part of the explanation is that the overall share of activity has increased in currencies that are not settled through CLS, the main means for obtaining PVP protection. In CLS currencies, it is possible that greater rates of internalization by market makers means that settlement risk is being mitigated without needing to use PVP services such as CLS. Many central banks conduct regular 6-monthly surveys of activity in their markets, a slimmed down version of the BIS triennial survey. And these central banks, which are all members of the GFXC, are enhancing their regular surveys to also capture data on settlement methods so that we can better monitor what is going on. The importance of this issue and the potential size of the risks involved means that settlement risks needs to remain a focus for the industry. Consistent with that, the GFXC concluded that it was appropriate to strengthen the code's guidance in this area. As part of the current review of the code, we'll be looking to further emphasise the need for market participants to sufficiently monitor and manage their settlement risks. And we are working with the BIS committee, the CPMI, as well as with CLS to get a better understanding of this and to discuss possible solutions. So these solutions not only include the credit risks associated with non-PVP settlement, but other elements of the settlement process as well. At its last meeting, the GFXC discussed the potential for strategic fails in FX settlements, which we've seen increasing evidence of over the course of this year. The incentives that can give rise to such fails and the adverse consequences for the broader market of these fails. Recent issues in the Turkish lira highlighted the importance of market participants making the maximum effort to complete their settlements to avoid exacerbating liquidity strains or otherwise disrupting the market. And the guidance in the code will also be strengthened to address this issue as well as the more general issue of the usage of PVP settlement mechanisms. So let me finish before opening it up for questions. So to conclude, the GFXC is aiming to complete the review of the FX Global Code by the middle of next year. Reflecting the feedback from market participants, the code that it broadly remains fit for purpose, the changes to the code will not be substantive. They will not, where appropriate, they reflect the ongoing evolution of the FX market. Besides focusing on the review of the code, the GFXC continues to discuss the functioning of the FX market, including around benchmarks and currently with a particular focus on FX settlement risk. All of the information about the GFXC's activity is available on the GFXC website, including the minutes of the discussions at our recent meetings, as well as a lot of other material to help market participants understand the code. So let me finish there and open it up for questions, which I'm going to confine to questions on the topic today rather than on conjunctural issues. So happy to take questions on the issues that the GFXC is looking at. So I understand if people type their questions in the chat box, I will be able to then answer them. So there's a question, is there any work being completed with WMR, specifically with buy-side users of the 4pm fix, to educate the relevance of stacking trade and swap value at this time of day and moving to different styles of benchmarking against alternative approaches? It's a good question. The point that the GFXC has been at pains to emphasise for quite a long time, and including previous work I did with the FX under the auspices of the FSB, Financial Stability Board, about 7 or 8 years ago, which resulted in the widening of the 4pm window from 2 to 5 minutes. One thing we've been at pains to emphasise over the past 7 years or so, and including again recently, is people have got to think about why they're using benchmarks, and particularly the 4pm fix, and consider whether that is best execution for them. And so we have been trying to educate people about the relevance of that fix and whether that is the most appropriate thing for them to be doing, depending on what their objectives are. So that has been an ongoing discussion over a long period of time. I suppose from WM's point of view, they are the provider of the fix. So they are engaging more with the market over and beefed up their user groups over the last year or so, which does contain both sell side and buy side participants. And I would highlight that WM is now providing the minutes of those discussions, which have, including their considerations, discussions around whether or not, you know, about the appropriate width of the window at the fix as well. And so I would very much encourage you to have a look on the WMR website around FX fixes, and you can find more information about the sort of issues that WM is considering. From our point of view, in thinking about usage of the fix, we are very much continuing to emphasise that people really need to think about whether usage of the fix remains fit for their purposes, be it the 4pm fix or any other fixes. So happy to take questions. I'm not going to talk about conjunctural questions, but certainly happy to take further questions on the issues that we're seeing around settlement and the like as well. Got a couple, 2 minutes left if there are any further questions before we head to a discussion about particularly focused on buy-side adoption in a minute. So another question, has there been discussion with the likes of MSCI and FTSE with respect to the use of WMR benchmark rates? Did have discussions with certainly with MSCI back when we did the FSB review, but we haven't had any recent discussions with them lately in terms of the way that they incorporate the WMR fix into their benchmarks. But again, I would encourage people who use those other benchmarks to again understand how they're incorporating the 4pm fix or whatever fix the FX fix they're using into those calculations. As I said, people are going to be using the fix. I think it's important to remind to understand how the fix is being generated and think about whether that's exactly the purpose that you want it to be put to. So let me maybe finish there, and we're about to rejoin you in a second for a chat about the general adoption of the code. Thanks. Hello again, slightly different venue, but happy to be joined by Susan and Buckley from QIC and David Mercer from LMAX. Susan's, I think, got to mostly chair this session. But, let me just start off talking about the future of the global code and can it remain voluntary. So let me give you a bit of history about how we ended up where we are and about why it is voluntary. So the first point to note is that the global FX code is indeed that. It's global. We have 20 foreign exchange committees from around the world, right across all continents, both EM and advanced and G10 currencies, and so a wide breadth of different FX markets.
And one of the main purposes, as I said a few minutes ago, for putting the FX Global Code together was to have one common code of good, better practice for the whole FX market rather than the multiple FX codes we had prior to that. So that's the reason why we have one global code. At the moment, we currently we have more than 1,000 signatories, more from the buy side, more from the sell side, sorry, than from the buy side. Those signatories are also from right around the world, and there's particularly strong take up in Asia across the banking sector and as well as the buy side. The code is principles based, and it isn't regulation. Basically, for the reason that, from my point of view, if you try and approach this with black letter regulation, you're basically doomed to fail because of the complexities of the FX market. And I've looking at the experience in other markets, I don't see that black letter regulation has necessarily been all that successful there. So hence the code is principles based. That also reflects the fact that we are across multiple jurisdictions, each with their own regulatory arrangement. So trying to work within the regulatory arrangements of each country meant that a regulatory approach was probably doomed to fail as well, and hence why we landed on a principles-based approach. That said, in some of the jurisdictions, including here in Australia, but also in the UK, the securities regulators use the global code in their surveillance of the FX market. So ASIC here very explicitly uses the FX global code in its surveillance of FX market participants. And similarly, the FCA in the UK references the global code in terms of its oversight of the FX market. So both, and not dissimilar situation in both Singapore and Hong Kong. In China, actually, it is law. The FX global code has been written into law in China, but they are the only country which has approached it from a direct regulatory point of view. Rather, as I said, here and in the UK, for example, it's very much references the global code in the regulator's approach to the market, which I think is actually a reasonably workable model. The ASIC has referenced the code in some enforceable undertakings it's taken against some of the banks in this market over recent times, and I think that has proven to be effective. So I do think the code can remain voluntary, but I do think it is also helpful where appropriate to have that regulatory backing to it. But I do also think that a complete regulatory approach to this is probably doomed to failure, in large part because of the fact that the FX market is a global market. It isn't a local market like an equities market or a bond market. It is a global market, often with participants on each side of the trade sitting in different jurisdictions. And hence, if you were to go down a regulatory route, you'd have to be very mindful of that. And that would the only way you could potentially do that would be a global regulatory solution, which I just don't think is feasible. So hence, I do think it needs to remain voluntary, but I do think some of that backing like we have here in Australia and similarly in the UK certainly can be beneficial. As I said, we've got over 1,000 signatories now. As I said in the talk just now, if I look at it from the buy side point of view, where take up has remained less than on the sell side, we have seen that of the top 30 asset managers, now more than half of them have signed up to the code. So top 30 asset managers by size around the world, more than half of them have signed up to the code, which is a better state of affairs than where we were a couple of years ago. And in each of the various foreign exchange committees around the world, we are, including here in Australia, we are reaching out to and talking to these asset managers, the larger ones in particular, and trying to talk to them about the potential benefits to them of signing up to the code, trying to understand what issues they might have as to why they're not, if that is the case, and trying to address them where possible, provide comfort to them where possible. So, in that ilk, let me hand over to Susan, whose institution is an asset manager who has signed up to the code, and I'd be interested in hearing her thoughts on that. Thanks, Susan.
Thank you, Guy, and hello, everyone. And thanks, Guy, for that context and background. And certainly I think we're all similarly motivated here on this fireside chat and beyond to see the proper, robust, liquid and effective functioning of this largest global financial market being the FX market, and see that continue well into the future. So similarly agree with the self-regulatory approach and sort of the voluntary take-up of the code. And Guy did mention the low buy-side take-up, and I guess I might just kick off with the motivation for QIC being an early signatory to this statement of commitment to the code. And it was important for us to have that public statement in demonstrating not only within QIC the best practice standards that we put on ourselves, but also role modelling and signing up publicly to support the industry in employing these best practices and ensuring that we've got a fair, effective, resilient and liquid FX markets. And I think from a buy side perspective, signing up to the code does help foster this level playing field with alongside our sell side industry participants, and noting that that the industry is sort of still somewhat fragmented and increasingly fragmented given electronification, and the code sort of helps us get to that one standard. So and then more broadly, this code and for the FX market and you know, it's very applicable more generally as well, fits with QIC sort of focus on you know, the G of the ESG principles that you know have been in discussion for many years now, and it gives me a lot of comfort as head of the business, the liquid markets business of QIC, that we have signed up in August 2017 to apply these best practices within QIC and support the industry in applying these best practices as well. And then also being part of the dialogue in how the code meets these standards, how it will evolve and be and future-proof for the years ahead. So whilst I guess I'm not a specialist FX trader or a specialist head of currency, that we have Stuart Simmons in that role for QIC. You know, from my perspective as the head of the business, you know, it was very important to support the signing up of the code and really do then, and we can come back to sort of what is the reluctance or the reticence from some of the other buy side participants. I think we've got less than 10% signatories from the buy side. We can go into that in a little bit more detail later. But, you know, we really should be turning the question around in terms of why CEOs and boards are not, you know, sort of asking why their organisations have not signed up to the code. And we can come back to that question. So I might just hand over to David now from that platform perspective, which is a different perspective again.
Thanks, Susan. Thanks, Guy. So hopefully everyone watching knows who LMAX Group are. We operate 5 exchanges globally. We've been in operation for a decade. We've always had a public rule book. And then you're probably asking yourselves, well, why are you here, David? You know, why are you on a code conversation? But a little known fact about LMAX Group is that we were the first signatory to the global code. That said, I don't agree with everything in the code, and Guy knows that well. Specifically, we can talk about principles 11, principles 17, but my point being, it's okay to disagree. And I think if, you know, one message overall I'd like to send back to the GFXC, and in fact, the whole FX industry, is better to engage. There's another saying about that, but better to engage and better to listen to a rounded, different view, right, of the FX marketplace. Frankly, we wouldn't be in existence as a group if there wasn't a need for transparency in the FX marketplace. Specifically, you know, if I look from an LMAX perspective, we only do foreign exchange. The so-called primary venues I call legacy venues and the last look ECNs are now owned by securities exchanges. We care about foreign exchange. At LMAX Group, we care about foreign exchange. And part of that is that we believe in that level playing field. And we also believe vehemently that the FX industry should be self-regulated. But for that to continue, we need to agree to a code of conduct. And you know, I'd like to congratulate everyone who's put it together, certainly led by Guy currently, and everyone in all the working groups. They've done a great job. Probably 55 principles is too much. Yeah. Probably there's some of those you don't agree with. But we've got to get behind it and we've got to engage. And I'd say to the working groups, you know, don't be afraid to engage with someone here, for example, who doesn't agree with your view, right? And the chair of a working group shouldn't necessarily be an advocate of one side or the other. But frankly, the alternative, and Guy's touched on it, the alternative is that we go for more stringent regulation. And you know, there's a lot more regulation that you're not going to agree with than what's in the code today. That's just the way it is. I'm a very heavily regulated group. I'm regulated as an MTF in the UK by the FCA. I'm regulated as a broker in the UK, and I'm regulated in five other jurisdictions around the globe. It's difficult. And there's a hell of a lot of that regulation I don't agree with. But so what? Right? That's the rules, David. Best abide by them. The difference with this code is we have input. As an industry, we have input. So best we get behind it, best we engage, and best we try and make it better, right? And then we can actually make the largest asset class in the world, the most trusted asset class in the world, the most efficient asset class in the world, and continue to be a self-regulated asset class. I rest my case. I'm sure we've got a lot more to discuss.
Thanks, David. We might just come back to that question of why there is this low take up from the buy side, and maybe if I just sort of talk through that, and then Guy, you might have some comments as well.
Yep.
I think, and certainly from, and David mentioned the 55 principles, there probably is some reticence because of the degree of sort of proportionality that may need to apply. So I think from a QIC perspective, we think that there's 40 of the 55 principles that are applicable to us, and we hold ourselves to the standards of those 40. So every institution and firm probably needs to then think about the direct or indirect activity that they have in the FX market and which principles are most important. But the framework is certainly comprehensive. The 78-page document is certainly a great framework to have a constructive dialogue both internally and then with the liquidity providers in the market. And it's pretty much, as David said, an off the shelf, ready to go framework for you to sort of think through how that applies, and obviously taking many hours of work to get it to this point. And I guess I would probably emphasize for those that think, well, it doesn't apply to us, we don't do FX. We don't trade FX, that's done by a fund manager. I think for every super fund out there, I think it's important for CIOs, CEOs to be thinking, well, how does this apply to our fund if we're signing up to this standard and this code, and ensuring that other managers and then counterparties are also also part of this industry practice. And then I think beyond that, there's obviously a whole corporate industry segment, I think, where there is also applicability. So there is that proportionality element. It doesn't apply I don't think it applies to me because my fund manager does that, or then there's probably general awareness too, as Guy said, in terms of all the other priorities on the list of super funds and corporates and so on, where this fits, and this will take some time and resources, you know, to think through, and it does need a champion. I guess we've been fortunate at QIC to have at those subject matter experts to really believe and champion the cause in the applicability of the code, and that sort of fed up through to the executive, through to the boards, and I think our you know, as industry leaders, I guess our role here is sort of to keep having this conversation, and you know, in my mind, it's the G of the ESG, and you know, it should sit up there in conversations along with climate change, modern slavery. It's the code, it's the practices operating within the largest financial market that we have globally, and it's there ready to go, and from a buy side perspective certainly does help level the playing field. So Guy, you might have some comments from your committees on other bottlenecks or obstacles to that buy side take up.
I think part of the question, as I said, is how you frame it. There are a lot of buy side participants, and what I, in something similar, what I care the most about is actually the ones who are large and have a material imprint on the market. You know, and particularly though, if you're executing FX within house, then you're as much a market participant as anyone else. And so I would certainly encourage those participants. But as I said earlier, if I look at the top asset managers in the world, we've got more than half of them now, which is what the positive way of looking at the other. Less positive way of looking at it, we haven't got the other half. One thing I would do want to pick up on is a point that David made, and has come through, and the same point's been raised in a question, is does the limited sign-up by the buy side imply disagreement with the code or some parts of it? As David mentioned, I do know that he does disagree with some parts of it, but nevertheless has still signed the code. And there are other market participants who I do talk to who haven't say that they haven't signed the code because they don't agree with parts of it. I would say last look is probably one of the ones which gets most frequently cited. Pre-hedging is probably about on equal par with it. And I suppose it depends on which way you want to look at it. I think it's important to have a code of practice, and you may not agree with all elements, and you may want to take it further than what we've got in the code, and that's absolutely your prerogative. But absent the code, we don't have any common standard of practice across the market. And I think that's unambiguously a worse situation. And I think the proof of that pudding potentially is in the eating, which was where we were before this, and why indeed the whole work to pull the code together came about. So we do know what the other state of the world looks like, and it wasn't great, particularly, I would say, for buy-side participants, what really wasn't that great. So I accept that everyone's not going to agree with everything we've got. In the end, we've pulled this document together, as I said, across 20 jurisdictions, across the whole breadth of market participants. And, there are going to be things which everyone doesn't like. I have had to mediate any number of conversations between people on all sides of these arguments. And in the end, there is a degree of compromise. I think there is compromise, though, without watering it down to motherhood statements. And as I said, anyone has the prerogative to take in their practices, certainly some of the principles we have further than what we've got. I certainly wouldn't be comfortable in someone taking them less than what we've got, but you absolutely have the prerogative to take them further. The other point, I think, is often where FX sits in the institution in buy-side firms. So there are some buy-side firms who are as large a market participant as any other, any of the large sell-side, not as a large sell-side bank, but certainly any of the second-tier sell-side banks. There are buy-side firms who execute more volume regularly than some of those. If you're one of them, then I think you are a significant market participant, and absolutely I would expect you to sign the code. But there are other organisations where your engagement with the FX market is indirect, maybe through an execution agent or the person who actually manages your fund. In that world, I don't have so much problem the fact you haven't signed the code. I think you should read it and understand how your FX business has been been executed. One of the things that when Paul Fisher and I were doing the work around the 4 p.m. fix, we were, let me go with stunned. I could pick a worse word if I felt so inclined. Stunned with the lack of knowledge by some very, very large institutions about the way their 4 p.m. fix orders were handled. And indeed, you know, pretty much no knowledge. And these were some very, very large flows. And often that comes from the view that, well, I'm an equity manager or I'm a fixed income manager and I'm not an FX person. It's like, okay, fine, but you're managing a global portfolio and FX is at least as large a risk, and particularly FX execution risk, as any of those execution risks within your equity portfolio or within your fixed income portfolio. And a very good example currently is the issue around settlement risk. You know, if you're on the end of the on the other end of a settlement fail, you will notice that, regardless of how that transaction is actually executed. So, at the very least, if I was a buy side participant, I'd like to understand what the issues are. You know, if I'm running a Turkish lira portfolio, you've got to understand settlement fail and how that goes. And understand how that the person who's executing the trades on your behalf, how they're handling that. So I get the point that for some organizations, FX is not a big part of their business. And there I'd very much emphasize that you should read the code and understand the parts that are relevant to you, particularly around execution. That's the part I would particularly highlight. And I take the point that there are 55 principles and not all of them are relevant. I actually don't think it's all that hard to read. It's written in plain Australian. It's not written in legalese. And, you know, it's not so hard to read, and so I would encourage people to do that. I also understand that on the list of priorities that particularly regulatory priorities that buy-side firms are having to address, this may be a fair way down the list. And again, absolutely understand that. And again, I would just encourage people to at least read it. They don't. But if you are engaging in the FX market in any substantive way, particularly as more asset managers are bringing FX execution in-house, then I think you've got to understand that you are a significant market participant and this absolutely should be applying to you.
Thanks, Guy. You mentioned also the review of the code. Obviously, we're coming up, well, past the three-year mark and a lot of progress has been made. Perhaps we go to David first on what you would like to see in the review, and then maybe Guy could give us a hint in terms of how he thinks this review might evolve in terms of how extensive, or is it sort of a more iterative approach, taking on board the feedback and the experience of the last 3 years. But over to you first, David, on your wish list.
I won't give you my wish list because Guy's heard it 5 years ago. But look, I think one point Guy said, and you've just said it yourself, right? This is an iterative process. And again, I go back to the point of engagement. So the way I look at it, what I do at LMAX Group is build a lot of technology. Effectively, we're a fintech company. And quite often, if I ask my tech guys, how long does it take to build this? They'll tell me it's a year. Well, I need to get product out the door before that. So we have this thing called MVP. Minimum viable product, right? Not most valuable player. And actually, that's the way I think guys just said it about the code. If you're struggling to sign up to it, see this as the minimum viable product. Honestly, there's not a lot to disagree with. I mean, I can disagree, and I will do. I disagree with pre-hedging, and I disagree with Last Look. It doesn't exist on LMAX Exchange. It cannot exist, right? We don't operate with Last Look. But that's okay, because practitioners use it, right? People who trade on LMAX use it, right? But if I look at the 55 principles again, you know, it's the minimum viable product. It's what you should expect as a customer. So I don't know what's holding you up, right? In terms of the three-year review, you know, I will have a little pop here at Guy and the GFX. You know, it needs to be more inclusive. You know, at no stage have I been asked to be part of any working group. That's just a fact. Why is that? I'm the most vocal opponent of Principle 11 and Principle 17. Incidentally, I'm not saying I have the time or want to be part of a working group, but it's okay. The working groups themselves have to allow an opposing view. Okay, FX for too long has been a closed shop, right? That's partly how we got there, right? How we got to the scandals, why we have a global code, right? Why we have a much more transparent market. It's not all down to the code, right? The FX market today is a much better market than it was 10 years ago. It's not all down to the code. It's down to the practitioners in it, the behavior of the people within it. It's down to some regulation. It's down to the improvements that technology have brought, right? But we must have inclusivity. Does the buy side, you talk about, I hear two different numbers there. You know, guy says 50% of the big guns signed up. You tell me 10% overall. Okay. Has the long tail, do they feel they've been included? Is it apparent they've been included? Have vocal opponents of a particular principle been made aware that they're included or that their voice has been heard? Guy's predecessor, I spoke to him in an airport lounge, right, at Heathrow, and he told me last look wasn't even a topic for debate, David, right? And you shouldn't push your commercial models, right? It's not a commercial model. It's an execution model, okay? That's all it is. But it's okay to have, again, to have a differing view. So what I want, I'd like the next 3-year review is more inclusivity, right? I happen to believe you're going down the wrong route with standardization around last look, because I think you're going to end up with a very long list, right? But if it's included, if it's acceptable under the global code, then you're going to have the long list. Now, the problem there is getting every practitioner to agree to the standardization of those standards. For example, hold time. What's acceptable? Let's get into the minutiae of it. Invariably in the code, you're going to say, if you agree to a hold time, it's okay. A hold time shouldn't be more than, pick a number, 100 milliseconds. Someone's going to say, well, David, I need 250 milliseconds in Israeli shekel. Right, maybe 5 years actually, but different long hold times than you need in, say, Eurodollar. So then you're gonna have this very wide standard, and then you go back to, you want buy side adoption, they're gonna say, well, hold on a minute, I kind of can't sign up to this hold time of half a second or 100 milliseconds when I know there's good guys over there that give me zero hold time. And then you get back into the disclosures again, Guy. I know you mentioned it in your keynote. I mean, they are expansive right now, but why can't they be, for example? Why can't they be if it's in a bilateral relationship? You sign up to the bilateral relationship, right? You agree to those terms of business. So if I was a bank liquidity provider, I'd say these are my rules of engagement, sign up or don't. And my whole time would probably say, as I see fit. And why not, right? So look, I think overall, I think there's some wrong turns being taken, but overall, I would say inclusivity, engagement, and with that inclusivity and engagement, you will get more adoption. But again, back to being a champion for the code, I'd say to the buy side, see it as minimum viable product. I don't see what you have to lose, if I'm honest, right? Because overall, we will iterate, Susan, to use your word, towards a better marketplace for all.
Yeah, I take David's question. I mean, we are, once we're trying to land some text over the next couple of weeks, 3 or 4 weeks, and then get it out to the market for general feedback. We'll propagate that out through the, around the world through the various foreign exchange committees, and absolutely put it there to get people's feedback on. We try to be as inclusive as we can while being workable as well. But we are certainly going to give everyone the opportunity to comment shortly. We hoped we had been at this point a bit earlier, but we had a pandemic come along and get a bit in the way. But we're hoping to get that material out for people shortly to get their comment where possible. We are going to get it out there shortly. Between now and sort of mid-November or so, across a number, and there'll be more than one iteration. We will probably iterate 2 or 3 times before the middle of next year, judging on how we went last time around, particularly on some of these issues where there's a wider a wide divergence of views. We do have a decently wide divergence of views of some of the members of the working group as well. So it isn't just people with one view. The working groups have a range of people from across the sell side and the buy side, but I do take David's point about trying to be as inclusive as possible, and we are trying to reach around the world. So, you know, issues like hold time are very much different, as you said, in euro dollar, whereas, you know, if I'm providing a quote in some of the African currencies, which get hit once every 5 days or so, that's a slightly different proposition. And one of the challenges of being a global code is trying to take account of all of those different situations. And we do get quite different feedback from, say, our African representatives on the GFXC and some of our Asian representatives and some of our Latin American representatives than we do from our European representatives on some of these issues. So, you know, I take the fact we haven't got a complete diversity of view, but we do aim to try and get a reasonable diversity. But we are going to give everyone the opportunity to comment more than once, hopefully starting in about a month's time or so. But as I go back to what David said, I think that's an interesting way of putting it. It's probably a more succinct way of putting it than I have in the past in terms of minimum viable product. It's like, you know, as I said, as David has emphasised, you may not agree with everything, but as I said earlier, you may want to take some stuff further, as LMAX does, than we do in the code, and that's fine. As long as you're shifting in that direction and not in the other direction. So I'd very much emphasise that. And I'd also emphasise that it's not desirable for people to pick and choose which principles they like and ignore which principles they don't like in the negative direction. Happy for, again, to take them in a more stringent direction? Perfectly fine. Have no issue with that at all. But it's not a question of saying, well, I like this principle, but I don't like this principle, this other principle, and I'll just ignore that in my practices. So I'd certainly endorse what David had said about the way to think about it. I think that is a useful way to consider it.
Thanks, Guy. And probably just on that inclusivity point, and I guess I speak from a standpoint of QIC being represented on the local FX committee and then the global FX committee as well, probably just give a plug for all the resources that are available out on the websites for the GFXC and as well as the local committees. Certainly in Australia, that committee list is very long. I might just point out it might not be as gender diverse as we would like, but from a diversity, another FX, diversity Susan. Perspective. But
Susan, you're the ones hiring the FX managers, not me.
That's right. That's a broader industry issue. But, you know, I would refer anyone who does not, you know, is familiar with the code and the resources. There's webinars, FAQs, and it's been a great effort to pull all this together with really part-time effort. And, you know, everyone on the committees have day jobs as well, and this is their contribution to the progress of the industry. And it might be worth discussing whether we are at a point where, you know, we do have to fund a self-regulatory forum. I mean, it might be worth discussing, Guy and David, as we sign up to the statement, are we at a point where we need some full-time resources for promotion, to you know, annual check-ins on commitments of each of the firms to help explain the proportionate approach? So I'd just throw back to you, would that be a step in the right direction?
We did actually think about that. And the execution of that is it's probably, it being a global body, again, this proved to be somewhat challenging in terms of the execution around that. But we did actually consider that that option for a while, but some of the stumbling blocks proved too big at the time. Doesn't mean we can't revisit it. Sorry, David, you were going to say.
Look, I vote yes. I discussed it with Susan previously. So, yes, we should contribute. Right, signatures to the code should contribute.
Yeah.
Look, part of that also helps me, don't get me wrong, you know, in that I'd like greater independence in the working groups. Okay. It's difficult because everyone's employees, and quite often they're employees of competitors. And it's the same when you look at banks, and it's not perfect. Mm. But let's face it, every single one of us is regulated by someone, and we pay a hell of a lot of regulatory fees. So let's not talk numbers right now, but it could be sizable so that we could fund some independence. We could even fund some, you know, marketing and PR for you guys, you know, around the world for the code, but certainly for some independent experts. So from independent chairs, I think you have, how many signatures do you have in total right now?
We went through 1,000 about 2 months ago.
So, I mean, look, we could all do the WhatsApp type maths, but we could end up with something sizable that wouldn't be onerous for a group like us, or a group like Susan's, or, you know, some of the big asset managers you've mentioned. So I vote yes. For one, you know, if it comes back up again, you know, put our tick in the box. I can't see there'd be any more onerous than some of the regulatory fees we pay every year.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a related question which has come through from the audience, which maybe I can put to you, Susan, because probably, you know, as I said, we've got now more, particularly this is very bit Australian centric, but it has global relevance. There are now more buy side participants executing FX in house rather than relying on a fund manager to do it for them. Should more pressure be placed on the buy side? I mean, maybe if I put it particularly succinctly to you, does ASIC have oversight of your FX operations, given you're not the largest player in the market, but nor are you the smallest?
Yeah, so obviously we are a fund manager as well as an asset owner, but we certainly act as an external manager for a large range of clients and operate commercially and under, you know, the regulatory regime here in Australia. And I guess we've got APRA as well as ASIC, I guess, have roles in this space. And as you mentioned earlier, I mean, ASIC is now taking the code as sort of the framework through which to regulate the FX market. So I think there definitely is a role for those types of institutions to be sort of asking the question, why haven't you signed up to the code? Not necessarily, you know, box ticking those who have signed up and sort of, you know, ensuring the adherence. I think we're still at the stage where those regulators should be asking super funds, corporates, why you have not signed up to the code, and that in turn may give us some more sort of insights into where this what are the stumbling blocks. That'd be my perspective. David, you might have a perspective from Europe in terms and the UK in terms of the buy side take up.
I think I've said it all, you know. I just think get on with it. But look, I do also understand their reticence, okay? Because unfortunately in capital markets, people have long memories and the lawyers have even longer memories. This case is still coming up from 7 or 8 years ago. You know, I wish you were almost able to have an amnesty. And say, because I don't see this Wild West that keeps coming up in the press, and invariably you read about it and it's 2013, 14, 15. I don't see that in 2020. So maybe they reserve their right just in case, you know, to a point earlier. Maybe they don't have a strong enough FX desk. Maybe they've never focused on it, right? Maybe there's some litigation coming down the pipes from 5 years ago, right? So it is difficult. I see the reticence from their legal teams, right? Don't forgo your rights here. Someone's going to use this against you in a court. So it might be that. So there'll be brighter legal minds than me that can tell them not to worry about that and you don't forgo any rights, right? Because it's just principle-based. There's just a bit of lethargy. And I think you're getting onto the right point there when you get the behemoths. And by the way, Susan, I think you manage over $50 billion, I think, so you're big enough to me. But there are some of the behemoths, you know, in the asset management crowd, if you get those names, then the long tail will follow. You know, the long tail will follow. You know, in the UK, you've got the Investment Association. I think their strap line is something like $7 trillion under management. They will vote as a group. That's the way I see it. And you've got some big names there signing up. So the long tail will come. So I think it really is a case of getting the big names first. I genuinely hope they join.
Mindful of time, Susan, I think we'll probably have to wrap up in a minute.
That's right. So any final comments, I guess, just from me, hopefully we've just highlighted how important this code is, and there's so many resources and a network for those institutions who are yet to sign up, and hopefully we've emphasised how important that take up is, and we've promoted that in this call today. So, Guy, any final comments?
No, just very much endorse that. I mean, and a lot of those resources have been put together by Stuart Simmons, who works who runs FX for Susan. So, thank him very much for that. And he's put that resources up very much as a asset manager, and the sort of considerations that they've gone through, the QIC has gone through in signing up to the code. So I would encourage people to look at that material from QIC and others, which is on the website, and give you some sense, here's how some of your peers have gone about it. And I very much endorse what David said. If we get the big names across the line, and we are getting more of those big names across the line, then that does set the example for others in the industry, and they can see the relevance of it. And as I said, in the end, and emphasize the point you started off with, Susan, what we are after here, the ultimate aim here, is an appropriately functioning FX market which works for all participants. And for that to be the case, we need all participants to be following a common standard. And our aim is very much what I think what we have achieved is an FX global code which does provide that standard, and as David said, at least a minimum standard which others can take to higher levels, and they absolutely have the option to do that. So let me finish there.
Great. Any final thoughts, David, before we sign off?
I think we let Guy finish, to be honest. I think he said it all. They've done a great job. So
thank you. Good talking to you three. You both.
Thank you, Guy. Thanks, David. And thank you all listening to us. Good morning.